Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And today, we are bringing back Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary. Michelle is the award-winning nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Hi there, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. And Rana is a columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times and CNN's global economic analyst. Hi, Rana.
Hey.
Okay, so the reason why we wanted to bring the two of you back is that 6 weeks ago, I spoke to both of you on the show. It's one of my favorite shows that we've done in this new world that we're living in. mostly because the two of you are so smart and everything you said turned out to be true. And so I wanted to just sort of check in with both of you and see how these past 6 weeks have been through your eyes and also what we have coming on the horizon. So, Michelle, let me just start with you. What have you seen in these past 6 weeks?
Well, more financial misery, of course. More people unemployed. More folks very worried about not having received their stimulus payments. Although the IRS and Treasury says about 88 million people have gotten payments, there are tens of millions who still haven't. Social Security recipients, veterans, folks with kids. So there's a lot of discontent and people worried about the bills coming up in May now.
I mean, discontent to say the least, actually.
Yeah.
The numbers that we're seeing are, I have to do like a double and triple take when I look over them, because 26 million unemployed Americans in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not through anybody's fault per se. I mean, we do need to shut down to try to stem the spread of this virus. But there were a lot of people on the edge before this happened. And when this pandemic hit, it pushed them over that edge. And it exposed the fact that we don't have a lot of ways to help people who are on the edge.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Rana, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm pondering what Michelle's saying. It's completely true. I mean, in a way, the virus has sort of pulled back the curtain on the truth within the U.S. economy, within the entire global economy. And it's interesting because when we spoke 6 weeks ago, we talked a lot about debt. And I was so interested to get Michelle's perspective and to talk in that way, because I think about it, with this massive debt bubble, which is now popping at the global level, in all areas, and we can dig more into that. But Michelle was talking about, debt for individuals and how important it is for working people in particular to stay away from debt, because it's always working people that are hit the hardest when the downturn comes. And that's what I'm thinking about a lot right now, is that, for individuals in this country, margins were thin to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that is part of a bigger decision that we've made as a country to have a debt-driven, consumer-based economy that is extremely oriented towards efficiency rather than resiliency. And I think that is something that is really going to be rethought and, I hope, change going forward. I think we're moving from a just-in-time economy to a just-in-case economy. And I think it's going to be bumpy getting there, but I ultimately think we're going to be in a better place.
You do? Because
I do. I'm talking 2 to 5 years, but what I'm saying is this virus has just, it's exposed all the rifts, all the inequalities, all the problems, all the vulnerabilities. And I think we're really having to look at them now, in all their ugliness and reckon with them.
So let's dig into this a bit more, because look, last 6 weeks ago, if I had to frame our conversation, it would be like we were on the precipice of this crisis and actually falling into it. And now it's like, are we looking ahead to a period of American austerity. And I want to talk through what that means and what that might be like. So Michelle, is kind of debt and the debt addiction from the global and corporate level all the way down to the consumer level the thing that – one of the things that ties everything together?
I believe it does. And I just want to start, you know, this is not the time to berate at least individuals. I'll leave one up to the corporations. But people make mistakes, you know, but my job at the Post and my columns is not to berate you at this point, but to try to help guide you through this. Mm-hmm. But leading up to that, if we're just going to look at, you know, looking back in the perspective, absolutely. And here's the thought, it's not entirely the individual's fault, because the whole system is designed to get you to think that debt is okay, and 100%. Almost okay at any level. I mean, look at the corporations. Why are these multi-million dollar companies, why didn't they have a cushion? Why aren't these Absolutely. Large landlords, why didn't they have a cushion that they can carry somebody for a couple of months? I heard from a landlord who didn't even have a mortgage, who was fretting about how they're going to pay their utility bills in July if their tenants who are unemployed because of the virus can't pay their rent. And I'm thinking, well, dude, like, what were you doing with the money that you were collecting from them that you can't carry them for a couple of months? Now, I mean, everybody has to take a hit in this. You know, we are all in this together. And if you as a landlord haven't done your job to make sure you have a cushion, you can't just blame your tenants when they can't pay their rent.
100%.
I actually had a rental property at one point. And I had a single mom who lost her job through no fault of her own. I was actually able to carry her for 6 months. And not only that, I did not charge her that back rent because I understood her situation. But that's because I'm a great saver and I didn't buy into this idea that I'm going to have an investment property and I'm going to spend every dime that I get in there and I'm not going to have a cushion. So I'm a little angry at some of these businesses and landlords who didn't have a cushion and can't carry people at a time that is extraordinary, that people are not working because they're like, hey, you know, I don't want to go out there and wear a mask. These people can't work because they don't want to die. And so I know I'm sort of passionate about this, but, and then there are individuals who were over. Now, I'm not talking about people just living on the edge who don't make enough. There is a swath of our population that, you know, vacations and cars and more house than they can afford. And now you're realizing that you shouldn't have listened to those folks who gave you all those credit cards and said, yeah, go ahead and buy this $40,000 car when you only make $50,000 a year.
Right.
And so you got to take ownership of the bad decisions that you make once we get past this crisis.
Well, I mean, first of all, never apologize for being passionate about this, Michelle. And second of all, I think taking that idea of taking ownership for this has to go all the way up to the highest levels. I mean,
oh my God,
right?
Yes.
Ron, I was just reading, Nick Baumgarten in The New Yorker was writing about how at the end of March, they're actually in anticipation of this financial crisis. There was frenzied buying in the debt market.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
No, it's insane. I mean, Michelle is absolutely right. By the way, I hope I didn't come across as blaming individuals. Absolutely don't. Every single thing in our tax code, in our corporate governance, in the structure of our financial markets is set up to encourage everyone from the highest level on down to take on debt. And there is one of the things that I wrote about immediately, as soon as the virus really, really hit hard in the U.S., was the problem of moral hazard. You know, if you go back to the great financial crisis, the term moral hazard was used for, you know, the idea that banks take on a lot of risk knowing that they're systemically important, so the government will bail them out when the bad times come. Well, individuals are not systemically important, so they often don't get bailed out. The exact same thing has happened this time around, and it literally makes me sick to my stomach that you have, you know, the airline business, for example. I mean, you know, important industry, don't get me wrong, but in the last 10 years, you know, 95% of cash was spent on things like share buybacks. You know, it was not spent on savings. It was spent on propping up stock prices. Most of that money, as we've talked about, you know, on this show in the past, goes to the C-suite, goes to the top 10% of Americans that own 80% of assets in this country. And then these industries, these big industries, because they are systemically important, get bailouts. Now, I've had folks from the labor movement say to me, well, this is important. We want to make sure our unionized workers are protected when these industries get bailed out. I totally get that. Unfortunately, what's been happening in these bailouts is often there are not enough provisions put in place so that these companies actually have conditions put on them taking federal money. You know, you've got to pay workers first. It's amazing how big companies have gotten incredible kind of carve-outs in provisions that middle-sized companies or even small companies have to abide by in terms of taking care of workers first and shareholders after that.
Do you think that, so as we turn to whatever the new economy is going to be or a rebooted economy, that this sort of long love affair with debt is going to start easing away a little, Rana?
I do. I mean, I look, you know, and I think I've mentioned this before. I look at this period that we're in very similar to the period between the run-up to the 1929 market crash and then the Great Depression. And, you know, if you look, that run-up started, actually, it started in 1918 or so, which was when the Spanish flu hit, a big pandemic. There was a crisis. There was a slowing of growth globally. And then central bankers cut interest rates in 1921. And then that was easy monetary policy, as we've had the last 10 years. It allowed for a real run-up in asset prices, which led to the 1929 crash. The 20s were actually very similar, interestingly, to the last 10 years. A lot of encouragement of people taking on credit, you know, two-thirds of purchases, you know, for white goods and things around the home were being made on credit. You had stock prices soaring, but then you had the 29 crash, and it took 2 or 3 years for the markets to finally bottom out. Growth slowed. And during that period between the 30s and World War II, you had a real increase in private sector savings. And I do think that we're going to start seeing an impulse towards that. And actually, if you look at savings by income, you can already see that anybody who can save, meaning people that have a bit of cash on hand, wealthy people, middle class people, they are saving more. And I think that as soon as working people are able to save more, I think the impulse will be to do that. And you look at behavioral economic research, it shows that whatever the kind of key seismic economic event is of your youth, that's what shapes your behavior going forward. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother, you know, uses a tea bag 10 times because she's a depression era person. My parents, who were boomers, took on a big big mortgage on a big house after they retired. So it's, you know, it's behavior.
Well, Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary, hang on here for just a second. When we come back, I want to try and look forward a little bit more with both of you about the changes that we might see at the personal and national level as well. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Rana Faruhar. She's a Financial Times global business columnist and associate editor and CNN global economic analyst as well. Author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. I'm calling her our macroeconomics specialist today because Michelle Singletary also joins us as well. She's the award-winning nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and author of The 21-Day Financial Feast. So we've got micro and macro here, and we're taking a look at what lies in the future of the U.S. economy, your personal economy, and the global economy as well. What is your austerity plan? Is that the world we're entering into, a world of American austerity? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Now, Michelle and Rana, I want to play for you a couple of clips from the Treasury Secretary who was on Fox News just this weekend, just on Sunday. So here is Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin speaking with Chris Wallace, talking about the fact that he is optimistic for an economic recovery.
I think as we begin to reopen the economy in May and June, you're going to see the economy really bounce back in July, August, September. And we are putting in an unprecedented amount of fiscal relief into the economy. You're seeing trillions of dollars that's making its way into the economy. And I think this is going to have a significant impact.
And the Treasury Secretary also then highlighted even more of the efforts coming out of Washington.
We've never seen anything like this. This is not the financial crisis. This is a scenario where we've closed the economy and we're going to open the economy. So all these models are based upon health assumptions, how quickly we reopen. So we'll see. My own opinion is, again, we have unprecedented amount of liquidity in the system. We're very sympathetic to all the people that are out of work, but there is enhanced unemployment. There's the PPP. There's direct deposits. This is going to put a lot of liquidity. And as businesses begin to open, you're going to see demand side of the economy rebound.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin on Fox News Sunday. Michelle, do you think that the demand, once people can go back out and consume and shop, that the demand side rebound is going to lift up the economy again?
Okay. You know, I can't say what I really think.
Yes,
on
you can.
So let me just filter what I really I don't want to get in trouble with my pastor. So I just think what he said was just idiotic, right? So if we have several months of people unemployed, not able to work, not being able to pay their rent or their mortgage, so when all of these forbearance periods is over, where there's a stop in what people owe, then there's all that money that has to be paid back. And then people were already on the edge, already not able to save. So now they haven't had income for several months. Now they have back things that they owe, utilities, car payments, rent, mortgages. How in the world can the economy jump right back to where it was? And quite frankly, we already know that the virus is still going to be here in the fall. People still need to practice precautions. Restaurants can't be jammed full like it was before. So those revenues are going to be down. Revenues are down statewide because people, you know, retail taxes, you know, business taxes, all of that is going to be down. So the states are going to be struggling with their budgets. Colleges are going to be struggling with their budgets. So, you know, is there going to be a rebound? Of course there will be. But by the fall, that's just crazy talking.
Yeah. Rana, you don't believe in the power of unlimited amounts of liquidity in the system?
Well, you know, I wish I could believe Steve Mnuchin that they were getting to the people that needed them. Unfortunately, that's not what's happened. I mean, we know there's been a lot of reporting on the fact that getting this money to small and mid-sized businesses in particular has just been a complete nightmare. It's not been getting through. Big companies with lawyers and lobbyists have been able to get to the front of the line. They've been able to get their cut first. Big institutions of all kinds. I actually just did my Monday column on what I think is going to be one of the areas that will be hit hardest, which is higher education. You know, I mean, there's been a huge bubble in higher education for some time. It's $75,000 a year to go to a private college. You know, you've got to be kidding me. You know, I'm a well-off person. I am struggling to think about that for my two children. We're going to see, you know, 30% of colleges, universities and colleges in America, were running a deficit before the pandemic. Okay. 15% had only 90 days of cash on hand. You're going to see a lot of them going bust. You're going to see a lot of small businesses never opening back up. So things will be very slow. Now, let me caveat. You may see when we get to the fall, and let's see through the summer, maybe you start to get a 10%, 15%, 20% opening into fall. You could see some pent-up demand coming back where people, you know, people that simply have not been able to get out, go out and consume to a certain extent. But that will, I believe, fall back. And I think you'll also start to see these dominoes that Michelle is talking about, the debt that's been built up that people have had to deal with over the last 6 months coming to the fore. Now, I think that particularly if we were to see a Biden administration after November, I think that there are going to be calls for some of these loans that have been made to individuals and small businesses to become grants. Mm-hmm. I think you may see calls for debt relief, debt jubilees in certain areas. I think we probably are going to have some of that.
So I want to ask both of you something, because I think the analogy or the metaphor of the two world wars in the last century kind of apply here in terms of the economic challenges that we have. Like, you could see 2008 as the first world war, the first big battle. And now here we are with an unfinished we had an unsatisfactory solution actually in 08, and now here we are in 2020. Now, what I don't get, or perhaps my personal frustration, is that in 2008 you could make the argument it was a financial catastrophe, was the failure of banks, etc. So maybe the financial instruments that we used to solve the problems were the right ones. Quantitative easing, lots of liquidity, et cetera, propping up those assets that you're talking about, Rana. But here now we don't have a financial crisis. Now we have an economic one, but it seems like we are still, we being policymakers, are still wanting to use the same set of solutions or a similar set of solutions. So why is that?
Well, you know, this has been an ongoing problem. I mean, we have an administration right now that has just completely bungled this crisis, it has to be said. So that's pretty singular. It's pretty extreme. But I would say that regardless of who would be in office, there has been a tendency over the last several decades for policymakers on both sides of the aisle, it has to be said, to pass the buck to the Fed. And so the Fed is the last organization standing. The only tool that they really have is to put money into the financial markets, or into the markets in general, via banks, and to buy up assets. And so the Fed can create asset bubbles, but it can't really change the story on Main Street. It can't walk down my neighborhood in Brooklyn and, you know, help the small business owner get back on their feet directly. It can't change the real economy, economic story. So that leaves us in a bind. I mean, what we need right now, and I think what I would love to see after the November elections, is a national competitiveness strategy, a national, almost an FDR New Deal type. Look, we have been through two wars, as you say, Meghna. We got to get back on our feet. Here's the plan. It's going to be slow. We're in it together. But that has to come from policymakers. That has to come from Congress and from the president.
You know, Michelle, I mean, look, the cynic in me is thinking it's just a lot easier for central bankers and policymakers to meet in rooms and make decisions and pump money into the economy, a lot harder to actually make structural change. But everything that both you and Ron are saying is that we need structural change. We need job training. We need infrastructure building. We need completely new policies to support the real economy. And so what if it's hard? That's what we have to do.
Well, we don't want to do that because it's often seen when it comes to individuals as a handout to undeserving people. So what we need structurally to change is affordable housing. Because here's what happens when you have affordable housing. If people aren't spending 40 and 50 and 60%, and in some areas, big cities, 70% of their take-home pay on housing, guess what they'll do with that extra money? Mm-hmm. They will save it. They will have a cushion for when we have maybe not this type of crisis, but a crisis, a normal crisis. When you have affordable health care, you have healthy people so that when a crisis comes, they are not susceptible to a pandemic like this. You have people who don't have high blood pressure, whose diabetes is under control. And then if you have jobs where people are paid a living wage, then they can save and send their kids to college without debt, so that when there is a slowdown or a recession, they don't have to rely on debt or get further into debt, so that when it ends, the recovery is quicker. So if we stop thinking and saying idiotic things like people need to just pull themselves up by the bootstraps, when they talked about the unemployment benefits, one of the folks in the administration said, well, people are going to get more money than when they were actually working. And we say things and do things without worrying about the people at the bottom, because when all boats are lifted when the tide comes in, you know, and that's what I'm concerned about. But we all go to these tried and true things. Like, just look at what the Fed does in terms of, you know, the interest rate, the Fed rate, which then impacts other things that we pay for. So savers, people who say, you know what, that market is a little crazy for me. I need some security. What can you, you can't even earn enough in your savings to keep pace with inflation.
Yeah, I think we may start to see a conversation again, depending on how the politics go, post-November, about changing a lot of things in the tax code, in different areas of regulation to incentivize savings as opposed to debt. And it's completely true what Michelle says. I mean, one of the key things to understand about why we are in the current position and why we're so vulnerable, let's set aside the pandemic. That would have been a hard, sharp hit no matter what. But what's happened is we have all this vulnerability. It's like an iceberg underneath that is now, that's now, you know, being exposed. There's been almost no inflation in wages for most people since the early 1990s.
That's
for
right.
a lot of working people, there's been no inflation in wages since the 70s. There has been triple the amount of average inflation in areas like housing, healthcare, and education. So all the things that make you middle class, all the things that allow you to be secure, have been exponentially becoming more expensive relative to people's incomes. And that's not sustainable. And it's funny, in a way, I mean, Bernie's out, but it's kind of Bernie's world these days, policy-wise. I mean, this is all these things are part of that part of the progressive left's agenda. And I think we're going to hear a lot more talk about
Rana, it. Rana, with all due respect, and I have only unlimited amounts of respect for you, I don't buy it. I don't.
Interesting. Well, no, give me your argument.
Well, and here's why. Because, like, the facts on the ground may logically lead to one set of policy tools.
Yeah,
but the facts on the ground in Washington are something entirely different. And, you know, if President Trump wins re-election, that's one thing. If Joe Biden wins in November, I still don't feel like it's, quote unquote, Bernie's world. You're talking about this, the former senator from Delaware, home of the S Corp, friend of banks. Seriously.
Right. No. Listen, Magna, we are on a knife's edge right now, and I'm trying to, it could go either way. And actually, it's interesting. I think we're even within the Democratic Party. I talked to a lot of folks that make policy. We're in a very delicate position right now. And I think we're going to be in that position for about 6 months to 18 months where there's a big policy fight going on right now. Is it going to be business as usual, or are we really going to see a change? And, I hope it goes the way we'd all like to see it.
Michelle?
I think we have short memories. I was reporting when the housing crisis hit. And I can see this from a couple of avenues because I write about this, obviously. But I also am in my community helping individuals one-on-one, looking at their budgets, looking at how they actually handle their money at all income levels. And for a while, we do start to save. You do see an uptick in savings rates. But then we go right back because we get comfortable and because obviously policies don't change. They just get, polished over. And so there's not some sort of systemic change that allows people to see that this is going to happen again, a recession, and we're going to be right back where we are if we don't do those things that we've been talking about, affordable housing, people making money, earning enough to take care of their family. Like right now, I think a lot of colleges will be hurt and people were right in the middle of deciding where to send their kids. And I have an immense battle with people, I got to send my kid to this school or they got to go out of state. And then they have to take on a massive amount of debt to do that. Then the kids got to earn a massive amount of money to pay back that debt. And then parents are taking college funds into retirement. Mm-hmm. We've got to change all that, I'm not optimistic that we will not remember what we're going through now.
Let me jump. If I can make one final point on this, it's interesting because whatever we decide to do as a country, we are in a global economy.
Yeah.
And part of our problem is the fact that because we're a debtor nation, a consumer nation, and China and many of the emerging markets are saver nations, producer nations, that dynamic is like a dysfunctional marriage. You know, it feeds on itself. But there is something happening right now, and it could go badly or it could go well, which is deglobalization. There's a kind of a regionalization going on. I mean, in part because of the trade war with China, but also the virus has exposed a lot of vulnerabilities. Many countries are thinking, gosh, you know, how can we make sure that we can produce our own masks or get our own antibiotics? Now, that some of that is smart thinking. It can also veer towards the nationalistic. It's important right now as we move to what I think is going to be a bipolar or a tripolar world with the US, Europe, and China kind of creating different, more regional orbits. That's an opportunity for us to rebalance our own economy a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's also an opportunity, frankly, for there to be a protectionist trade war of the kind that we saw post 1929, which is one of the things that deepened the great, us into the Great Depression. So again, knife's edge right now.
Knife's edge. And Michelle, we've got about a minute before we have to take a quick break. What do you think about that?
I think she's right on point. I think there's a way that we can do both, that we can we need to have foreign goods coming in and we need to have this trade thing, but we got away from manufacturing our things. And maybe I'm hoping that we can bring some of those manufacturing jobs back and people can make a decent living so that when we move forward, when we do have another recession, we won't fall so hard. And I will just say this as consumers, because I'm a penny pincher, I'm frugal, but we cannot continue to want to get a shirt for $1.
Right.
And we need to do our part to recognize that if we want people working and have a living wage, that we can't continue to be buying stuff at the cheapest, which of course creates all kinds of other issues about labor. But we need to do our part to say, you know what, I need to pay a fair price for this shirt so somebody can make a living who made that shirt.
And maybe I don't need one every other week, a new one every
That's
other
exactly
week
right.
as well.
That's
so
right.
Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar, stand by for just a second. We've got a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar, two women who I still think need to have a podcast together because they are such brilliant thinkers about this economic moment. Michelle, of course, is the nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and Rana Faruhar is FT global business columnist and associate editor and also a global economic analyst at CNN. Now, you know, I actually promised listeners that in the previous segment I would talk to you both about this framing that I kind of want to apply to this conversation about American austerity, and I didn't do that, so sorry about that. But Rana, let me just ask you, both of you quickly, are we entering a period of austerity, and what does that look like in the American context?
Yeah, I think we are. You know, I'll go back to history. You know, in that period between the 30s and World War II, American savings rates actually went up to about, I think they were at their high of 28%. How about that, Michelle? Can you imagine it? It's like positively Chinese in 1944, 1945. Now, part of that was about forced rationing because of the war. Part of it, interestingly, was because we had a pretty strong export economy back then. This goes to Michelle's point about manufacturing. Had a strong export economy. We were exporting a lot to Europe because of the war, and incomes were relatively high still. So people were able to save 28% of their income. Now, that went back down after the war. It reached a bottom in about 2005, 2006, little over 2%. Interestingly, it's been going back up slowly since the great financial crisis. So I think that people have realized, hey, we need to have a little bit more of a cushion. But of course, given the, what we talked about before, yeah, that's limited because, you know, the amount of disposable income that people have is just limited. Now, in order to be able to rebalance our economy and have, you know, some consumption, some consumer demand driven parts of growth, but also some production, some income-based growth, you have to be able to shift things at a top-down level. You have to have a government that says, you know what, we're going to take a 360 look at the country, at where jobs are, at, you know, where areas are that have felt more pain. Right now, we have a very, very lopsided economy. You know, most of the growth, the vast majority of the growth and the income or the jobs are concentrated in just a few coastal cities and a few kind of internal areas that are basically high-tech or services hotbeds. And that's unsustainable, I think. We need to create a broader growth in a broader number of areas with a different, you know, lots of different kinds of jobs.
Yeah. So, Michelle, this is what I'm worried about. If and I completely agree with both of you that the what we have now is not a system that's set up for the possibility of high savings rates, right? That positive possibility of high savings rate. So does that mean that this time around, the American austerity in whatever form it takes will have a lot of prolonged suffering if we can't even – people just physically cannot set aside that cushion that, that you're talking about we all need?
I think there will be. And let's not forget that there's a lot of population that was already in forced austerity.
Yes.
And so they already know what it's like, yeah, to live with less. And they will be further behind when this is over. And I agree, Rhonda. I think that we need to have balance. I'll just give you a quick example. So I wrote a column recently about if cash is king, being mortgage free right now is king as well. And the idea is that when you can, as fast as you can, get rid of the biggest expense in your budget. Now, that would just, I mean, you wouldn't think anybody criticized for me for that, right? You know, and it's like, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. You should put money in the market. And so we have developed a culture that wants you to hang on to the biggest debt right into and beyond retirement, with the idea that somehow if without this mortgage, you're going to be less financially well off. When in fact, when a crisis hits, if you cannot be pressured by the biggest thing in your budget, you can get through that crisis a little further. And you can, for some parts of the population, pay off that mortgage before you retire. So we're not just talking about retirees. So then what would they do with that money? They will be freed up to spend it and not just spend it on debt. But we have to really change our thinking. So I think that forced austerity could be good for a lot of people who think that this rolling economy, because they are benefiting from it, can go on forever.
You know, can I jump in on the housing, on the mortgage issue? Because it's an interesting example and it kind of highlights a lot of what we've been talking about. I actually have a very large mortgage right now. Now, I could pay down probably half my mortgage right now, but that mortgage deduction is my main tax shelter. That is a policy decision that we've made as a country, that we encourage people to take, to buy larger houses and to take on a lot of housing debt. We give people a deduction for it in the tax code. That actually drives up prices. Interestingly, I think the price of my house would probably be half of what it is unless everyone in the neighborhood couldn't deduct that huge mortgage, right? Now, blow that out at the 35,000 foot level. That's the same for companies.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and that's actually a bigger thing. I mean, the mortgage tax deduction is, you know, it's a hard thing to get rid of because it's the shelter, tax shelter for most people in the country. But it speaks to something else, which is that corporations are incentivized to take on debt. They're not incentivized to save. They're, you know, going back to that very first example, why do we need to do all this, all these massive corporate bailouts right now? Michelle's point, why did these enormous, incredibly rich corporations why did they not have a cash cushion? Because they're not incentivized to do it.
Because it was great to be leveraged to the hilt.
It was great. It's, It's great to be leveraged to the hill. And the policy that we have set up since the 1980s onward has encouraged that. So this isn't going to be a quick fix. This has been decades of small tweaks to the system that have led us to this point. We're going to have to start unwinding all that now.
But and just really quick about the whole mortgage interest deduction, you do realize that the people who take that are wealthier.
Absolutely.
The average American family 100%. Doesn't even get that deduction. So we're sold houses based on this tax deduction that most homeowners do not take because they take the standard deduction. So who does it benefit?
That's right.
Higher income families who
Which
can
has
afford.
Which has a trickle-down effect correct. Of driving up prices. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Which makes it so that there's no affordable housing.
Okay, so we've got a couple of minutes left. And I want to try and do a little solutions thinking here. And in fact, I asked you guys this same question to wrap up our last conversation 6 weeks ago. But Michelle, if there were one policy or even behavioral, what you take your pick. Fix that you would want us to see as individuals or as a nation institute right now, what would it be?
To get rid of our love affair with debt.
Yeah.
Absolutely, hands down. We have got to stop telling people that they need to borrow whatever it takes to send their kid to college. We have to not be buying cars that we can't, you know, we spend 6, 5, 7, 8 years. We have car mortgages now. We too much house or credit card debt if you don't own a house. I mean, I think our nation, our federal government's love affair with using debt when we get in trouble and being okay with being in debt, which then trickles down to individuals who then get criticized when they have debt, when the minister, the Congress and all these folks are saying, oh, those people should not have all that, have all this debt. So for me, it's debt. It's debt, debt, debt. Debt is evil. It is crushing. And I would just like to see us not get to the point where obviously there's some debt you have to use, but just get rid of this love affair and with debt and using it to fix our economic problems.
Rana, what about you?
I would say we need to start thinking more as a country about resiliency instead of efficiency. And that's at both the macro and the micro level. I mean, companies, you know, the entire process of globalization since the 80s onward has been about let's strip costs out of the system. Let's send our corporate savings to tax havens. Let's send our jobs to where labor is the cheapest. Goods and capital can kind of move 35,000 feet above individuals, but individuals and workers still have to stay on the ground and deal with problems within the countries that they live in. We need to start thinking about, you know what, we're in it together. Let's build a system that has more resiliency. And that means changing a lot of things. It's not going to be an easy process, but there are other countries, there are rich countries that have made different choices. You look at Germany right now, you look at some of the Scandinavian countries, they've made different choices to have a more balanced economy. And I'd like to see that conversation happening.
Well, I actually want to have that conversation in multiple ways on this show, because I think through creative thinking, we can find a way that maybe doesn't pit resiliency against efficiency, but maybe we redefine what efficiency is a little bit so that we can have resiliency as well. I mean, it's a thing that we all collectively should be thinking about a lot. So with that, Rana and Michelle, will you come back again in another month? We can do this again?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Love to. Okay. I learned a lot from Rhonda. I was like, oh, I didn't know all that stuff about 20s. But pay that mortgage off, girl.
Okay,
well,
my God.
I love now, your enthusiasm, Michelle. I love it.
I also think that maybe we might want to save more if we earn more than 0.25% on our savings accounts in the banks.
That's
but
right.
That's for another
that's
day
exactly right.
entirely. So Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and author of The 21-Day Financial Fast. Thank you so much for coming back, Michelle.
You're so welcome. I love it.
And Rana Faruhar, CNN Global Economic Analyst and Financial Times Global Business Columnist and Associate Editor and author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. Rana, thank you so much for coming back as well.
Thanks, as always, Megan.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Jack Beatty. He's On Point News Analyst, and he's been listening in from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Megna.
So what do you think about this notion that this nation is entering a period of American austerity?
Well, it's certainly entering a period of great economic distress. The IMF said last week that the world, not just the country, is facing, quote, the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. You know, what was the Great Depression like for ordinary people? And how does that prefigure what people will experience today? Well, a metaphor offered for the Great Depression, I think, captures that. The metaphor is the big knife. It was coined by Helen and Robert Lind in their book Middletown in Transition. They were the authors of Middletown, a classic in the 20s, portrait of Muncie, Indiana. In the 30s, they went back in the middle of the Depression to look at Muncie. And what they found was that the big knife of the Depression had come down over the lives of people, sundering them into before and after. Arthur Miller's play, The Price, captures the moment when the big knife falls on a family. The scene is the attic of Walter and Victor France's parents. They're long dead. They're selling off the furniture. The furniture is packed up there. The time is the 1960s. They're looking back on the Depression. And Victor is talking to his wife, telling her about then. My mother, the night he told us he was bankrupt, my mother, it was right on this couch. She was all dressed up for some affair, I think. Her hair was piled up and long earrings. And he had his tuxedo on. And he made us all sit down. And he told us it was all gone. And she vomited all over his arms, his hands. Just kept on vomiting, like 35 years coming up. And he sat there, stinking like a sewer. And a look came into his face. I've never seen a man look like that. He was sitting there, letting it dry on his hands. The moment when the big knife of the Depression fell on the Franz family, separating their lives into before and after. And in the fear economy, replacing the consumer economy, even as we speak, that dialogue, that moment, that big knife, is going to fall on so many families as they break into before this crisis and after.
People are already using that language and talking about their experience even in this immediate moment about, you know, before life was like this. Now it's so wildly different. Again, the suddenness of it all, Jack, I think is one of the most shocking things here. But maybe we shouldn't be shocked because, as Rana and Michelle talked about with us, I mean, the stage was set for a crisis like this. And coronavirus, the pandemic, is simply what pushed us over, right?
Yes, and it sets up, you know, dueling imperatives, you know, health and prosperity, life and life, Dr. Redfield said that we're going to have another wave of this in the fall. In 1918, it was much worse in the fall. And if that happens and the economy shuts down again, ask yourself when you will go to a movie. Ask yourself when you will go to a restaurant. The entire service economy, people who, you know, whose lives are all connected with that, they're going to go down. Their lives will never recover from this shock, as fear becomes the ruling emotion of our economy. In that sense, I think this is probably going to be much worse than the financial crisis, because this is psychological. This is, we don't want to go any place where people are, so long as this virus is out there.
Right. And the lingering psychological effects, again, to learn from the example of the Great Depression, that lingering psychology lasts for, what, generations? A generation, at least?
It does. And in fact, you know, the stock market didn't recover its 1929 highs until 1954, because the Silent Generation wasn't into the stock market. They were into savings because they had known what desperate economic insecurity was like. So, yes, it lasted and lasted and lasted.
Well, Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, speaking with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, folks, tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about wildlife in the middle of this pandemic. As human beings have had to shut themselves in, have you noticed more animals in your area? Birds, bees, larger wildlife, cougars, coyotes even. Tell us what you have spotted from through the windows of your home, on your streets. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.